This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today I'm joined by longtime celebrity publicist, founder of Overcat Communications, and now author, Audrey Hyams Romoff, who has written a stunning, gripping, and spectacular memoir, The Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma. And as I showed Audrey, it's very dog-eared, this copy, that seamlessly stitches together several stories in a powerful and compelling manner. First, the central tragedy, the deaths of both of her parents, is what opens and closes Romoff's fascinating and heart-wrenching memoir. This story spans four generations of women in Audrey's family, including her grandmother and mother, who were both Holocaust survivors and were liberated from Auschwitz. The patterns they learned became the ripple that moved through their family, spanning four generations of women. All of this is juxtaposed with Audrey's glamorous life. She's well known to Toronto's fashion and entertainment media as the owner of the publicity firm Overcat, where she's worked with such stars as Jennifer Lopez, Katy Perry, Sarah Jessica Parker, Lady Gaga, Amanda Brugal, and high-profile brands including Longines, Estee Lauder, and Victoria's Secret. Audrey Hyams Romoff's memoir, The Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma, is about intergenerational trauma, grief, and resilience, and it's now an Amazon bestseller. On a lighter note, don't get me started on the Montreal references. As a former Montrealer, I loved every minute of it, but more on that later. Before we meet Audrey, let me just tell you a little bit more about her. Audrey Hyams Romoff was born and raised in Montreal. Her father, Bram, was a radiologist, her mother, Rachel, a nurse. Rachel was one of the youngest children to survive Auschwitz concentration camp, and her lingering trauma had a profound effect on her family. Audrey moved to Toronto to pursue a degree in English literature. After a series of jobs in marketing and communications, Audrey founded Overcat, a boutique agency specializing in fashion and beauty clients. While Audrey balanced marriage, two children, and a high-profile career, her mother continued to struggle, and in 2008, Rachel chose to end her life in the garage of their family home. Her father also passed away in the garage that day, but the circumstances of his death remain a mystery. Audrey's memoir, The Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma, explores four generations of women in her family and how secrecy can have devastating consequences. Audrey, congratulations on your tour de force and welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Thank you for that beautiful introduction, Judy, and I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy this worked and that we are connected finally. Audrey, I know you thought about writing this book for a long time. What finally motivated you to sit down and write this deeply personal, authentic, and compelling memoir, The Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma?
You know, after my parents died, really the only way that I could cope was to block them out. And I think anyone who's gone through any sort of grief and trauma, no matter what the origin of it is, knows that it's a journey that's not necessarily linear. So, you know, say I banished my parents, I didn't look at photos, I really couldn't deal with it at all. And then we bought a new house and I had all these boxes in the basement that were shipped from my house in West Mountain, Montreal. And I decided, you know what, you have to be brave enough to go through these boxes. So I did do that. And there were thousands of pictures. So I guess it sort of shifted my feeling a little bit. And there was one picture in particular of my parents when they were very young. I would assume just after they were married. I don't think I was born yet. It's a black and white picture. And my mother's in a gown. My mother was very pretty. My father was in a tuxedo. And they were just looking at each other and they were so happy. And I thought, I'd spent, you know, practically a decade and a half blocking that out. And that was sort of the impetus for sitting down and saying, let me take another look at this again, because to me, after they passed away, it was like a steel door slammed shut. It changed everything that went before it.
Absolutely. We know that an eclipse, one of the words in the title of your book, happens when a planet or a moon gets in the way of the sun's light. And in this book, and after a family tragedy, this story is about how one woman, you, made your way back to the light. Can you tell us more about why you titled the book Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma?
You know, ripples were really the thing that emanated from my mother, essentially from the time that I was born. After she was liberated from Auschwitz, she was in a displaced persons camp in Gelbethen, Germany for 3 years. Then she made her way to Canada as an 11-year-old. Her mother remarried, and she really wanted to fit into the fabric of Canadian society. So that's what she did, and she married a doctor. But you know, she had this very carefully constructed sort of facade. But what she found was after I was born, I'm the oldest, that she just wasn't like everybody else. You know, she had this very heightened anxiety. She had this need for control, which sort of just kept escalating. And it was really all about keeping me safe. So the ripples were really about the effect that she had on me throughout my life. And then eclipse, unfortunately, refers to when my parents died, which obviously had a profound effect on me. But my daughter, who was 16 years old at the time and very close with my mother in particular, both of us went off the rails and took a very long time to get ourselves back, try to figure out what our lives look like now. So the eclipse was really, there was no light.
Yeah. You had a very difficult, tumultuous relationship with your mother, which later, I think you started to have different feelings after going through the boxes and going to Auschwitz and many things. But back to the beginning, she was very overprotective. And you found that difficult because I think you're an independent type. Yeah. And it just made you want to flee because she would make you wear a snowsuit underneath your Halloween costume. And she didn't want you to take the city bus when your friends were taking it, but insisted on the school bus. Yeah. And there was no skiing, no biking, no this, no that. Can you talk more about this way that you were raised by this mother who was really petrified of everything and tried to hold you back while you wanted to move forward? Ultimately, you left for Toronto at 20 years old to have some freedom. But can you talk about that dynamic and what that was like for you?
You know, my mother would acknowledge that she had no examples of how to be a mother because she was raised in this crazy environment. She was 2 when the war broke out. Then she was in a ghetto. Then she was in a labor camp. Then she was in Auschwitz. And then she was in a displaced persons camp. So she didn't have any frame of reference. The only person who survived on her mother's side was her mother. There were very few relatives that were left. So there was nothing. So she was sort of doing the best she could. But I don't think she could really separate the fact that she was in a reasonably safe place in Canada, married to a doctor, living in a nice house. You know, her kids were in private school. We never wanted for anything, but she couldn't mesh those two things together. You know, she so desperately wanted to rebuild her life. Like I think many people who have experienced trauma, and you're very focused on that. But what you don't realize sometimes until it's too late is there's a lot of stuff that's still there to overcome. And my mother was not someone who was willing to do the work to overcome it. You know, she didn't really go in for seeking help or anything like that. And, you know, I think one of the reasons is, you know, I sort of think of it as if she was like an onion, you know, that there were so many layers to her and she was terrified to undo any of those layers because she'd worked so hard to get to where she was.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And in spite of all of this, there were moments of great joy for you and your mom, you know, in your childhood, things like going shopping every Saturday morning. I pictured you on St. Catherine or St. Catherine's, as we Anglophones would call it, and shopping at Ogilvy's and at, you know, right there, right? And I could see that. And of course, you would pore over those Vogue magazines together, which really, I think, paved the way for your entree into the fashion and beauty world. Like she was very pivotal in that area for you. So there was joy as well. Well, but it was a push-pull. And I think that when you went to Toronto, and as you've described, that you later found out that this represented total abandonment, which for a Holocaust survivor is akin to being that she may never see you again. That's how she equated it. And that's why she had such paralyzing fear about it. There were also difficult moments. There's one moment in the book that I couldn't get out of my mind, and that was at the scene of your cousin Charlotte's wedding. It was so painful to read when your mother kept staring at, and you write it so beautifully, and I'm not going to give it away. I want people to get the ripple eclipse and to read this, but after so many courses, she kept staring at you and staring at you. You'd just gotten a shag haircut in Toronto. We know Toronto doesn't have the same stylist as Montreal. A bad shag haircut, to be sure. And she said, finally, I can't bear to look at you. So that must have been so painful. So I understand a comment like that must have hurt so much, and how deeply painful that must have been. Can you say more about this part of your relationship with your mother?
You know, I think that there's a few central tragedies to my relationship with my mother, which one is that she wanted to have an amazing relationship with me. You know, I have an incredible relationship with my daughter, and it's so important to me. And my mother wanted that. But my mother, you know, and I would say to her, well, you know, you're going to have to back off on this, and we're going to have to do this. You know, she would say, you know, I can't do that. Her need to control, her need to make sure that I was protected, superseded everything else. And that's, it's not what she wanted, but she couldn't use the tools to get results there.
Right. The fear was greater then. And I know you have this beautiful relationship with your daughter, but you've worked on it. You've been mindful about it. And you even went to therapy once with your mother. And it's such a poignant moment in the book when I believe the therapist looks at you and says, Audrey, you're the adult. And she points at your mother and says, and you're the child. How did that land for you?
I mean, it was sort of awful because when that happened, just in the context of timing, it was a few months after I had moved to Toronto. And you're right. You know, my mother felt totally abandoned. And then one of the things I wrote about in the book is when I went to a Holocaust conference, you know, there were other children with survivors who were saying to them, leaving was equated death. So it wasn't that she was sad that I left. She was actually mourning me as if I had died. So that was what she was very much in the throes of when I went to see the therapist with her. And I'd never been to a therapist before. I think she'd been to one appointment before. And it was really my mother who was talking and going on about all the things that I had done to get us to this point and why she was so upset with me. And, you know, 30 minutes into the session, he looks at me and he says that, you know, you're an adult and you're the child. And there was two reactions to it. One, it was shocking for me because it never even occurred to me that was going on. But the other was, I actually felt very badly for my mother because it was such a horrible indictment of her. And, you know, she'd been in two appointments with this psychiatrist. And I thought, how irresponsible. Like, you know, I knew my mother's psychological makeup. This therapist didn't know my mother's psychological makeup. And I thought that was pretty irresponsible. And, you know, she did one more session because my father insisted that she go to three sessions. And then that was it. And she didn't seek help again, Miller.
You know what, Audrey? It's so outward focused of you that you felt bad. It's so interesting because it is the parent and the adult role to say what you've just said, that even then as a young person, you were outward focused enough to have compassion for your mother. And I love in the dedication of the book, and you dedicate the book to your mother, to your grandmother, to your husband, Michael, and to your two children. But I love what you say about, and even the beginning of the book is to your mother as well, but I'm going to let everyone read that. But I love the way you say, this book is dedicated to mom. Even imperfect love is still love.
Is that because she loved me? You know, she loved me. And, you know, there was people in my life who would say, you know, maybe you need to separate yourself from your mother. And that was absolutely out of the question for me. You know, it was, we were all in this together. My grandmother was an incredible human being. My father was the person who I saved,
the love of your
saved my life. And, you know, my mother was damaged. And I don't think, and you talked a little bit earlier about the journey that I took and how I came to view my mother maybe a little bit differently in my later years than we've been in the early years. And that's very much true.
And just back to the Vogue magazine for a second, because it really, your father helped you in terms of life and career lessons in many ways, because he was such a brilliant doctor and a wonderful guy. And he just sounded like a real mensch, kind, compassionate, outward focused, as you just revealed that you are so much. But your mother also paved the way for your entire career.
She did.
Because,
Oh, absolutely.
What was, Was it, can you describe what that was like, sitting with your mother and going shopping or reading the Vogue magazines, and how it really helped your style and your sense of fashion and everything that you do?
Well, the Vogue magazine was a little less contentious than going shopping because, you know, you have children, daughter, and you know what happens sometimes when you go shopping. There can be a little push-pull there. So not everything was a great experience. But Vogue was such a big thing. And like literally my mother would go through the pages and she would say, this is this model, this is this model.
Wow.
This designer who is known for this. And, you know, she did ignite that passion. And one of the things, I mean, obviously when you lose someone, there's a lot of things that they miss out on. And I know this sounds like something very frivolous, but there was a documentary that came out, I think it was like the year after my parents passed away, that was about Valentino. And, you know, I was watching it. I guess I had the CD at the time and I was watching it at home. And I was weeping through the whole thing because all I could think about is my mother would have loved this. And, you know, we could have watched it together. And she was also such a student of popular culture. Like, I don't know if anyone knows this, but People magazine really sprung from Time magazine. So Time magazine had one page in every weekly issue that was called People. And it was, you know, talking about celebrities and stuff like that. And then People magazine launched. So I was onto that right from the beginning. And particularly with Lady Gaga, I thought, oh my God, my mother would have just been so enamored with everything that Lady Gaga did. So a little more able to allow myself to feel those things now than when I was, you know, pushing all the emotions away.
You talked about how your dad saved your life. Your dad, radiologist, doctor, kind, benevolent. He just sounds like he was a wonderful person. Can you tell us more about your father, Bram, and your relationship with him and the lessons that he taught you and gave you that you carried forward in your life and career?
You know, my father, first of all, I mean, like many doctors, he had that type of personality. But my mother was very critical of me. My mother was tearing me down a lot. And my father really looked at me with this wonder, you know, all the time. And, you know, sometimes I remember he would show up and he would, you know, I studied dance a lot when I was younger. So he would come pick me up and he would like come into the class while we were doing class. And I'd be like, oh my God, you know, this is not appropriate. But he had a great sense of humor. My mother did not have a great sense of humor. And he really loved Woody Allen movies. And so I became a very willing participant to start seeing Woody Allen movies, I mean, probably in 1973. So I was 10. And my mother wouldn't go see them. So I went to them. And my father chose to put himself in a very difficult position because he stood up to my mother. And that created a very difficult dynamic between them as well. You know, particularly like when I moved, he was footing the bill for me. She held him responsible for that. She created a lot of people in his life. You know, he really supported me when I started my career. And I would, like, because I sort of didn't know what I wanted to do. And so many people were like in law school or med school or doing their MBAs. And I don't know, I was an assistant to a marketing director at Young & Bloor. You know, I was not going anywhere too quickly at that time. And he said, if you work hard, people will notice. And I was in my early 20s. And I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. But he was absolutely right. That became my mantra. You work hard and people will notice. It's not about telling everybody what you do or what you plan to do. It's about just doing it. And my father was a doer. And my mother was less so a doer because I don't think she could handle a lot of things. But it's interesting because I think from a very young age, I sort of realized I need to pattern myself after my father, not my mother.
You were dying for independence. And even when you went to summer camp, there's such a poignant moment in the book when you describe the joy you had swimming across the lake at summer camp. And I could just picture it. I don't know what camp it was, but I have an idea of one of them that it could have been. And your mother said to you after, at my camp, we didn't have any swimming.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you had the joy, but then you'd hear a comment like that. And how did going to Poland and Auschwitz with your daughter, Lindsay, many, many, many years later, help reframe a lot of these memories?
I was not one of these people who sought out every detail about what happened in my family. I very much feel like I lived with the reverberations of the Holocaust my entire life. And I was working with a gentleman named Malcolm Brabant, who co-wrote daughter of Auschwitz, and he was a correspondent for BBS NewsHour, and he was sort of my de facto mentor. And so he called me up last November and said, you know, PBS is interested in you going to Poland and Auschwitz and tracing your family's stuff. But he, for the 2 years that we've been in touch, he kept telling me I had to do that and it would be really important for the book. And I kept saying, no, Malcolm, I don't want to do that. Because I think when you've gone through a lot and maybe similar to my mother and her, you know, onion skin, I felt like I've gotten myself here. Why do I want to open myself up to something that's really scary territory? Mm-hmm. But Malcolm was very insistent on it. And then I said, okay, if I can go with my daughter, Lindsay, who was 32 at the time, then we'll do it. It was an incredibly, incredibly difficult trip. I have to say, I felt pretty uncomfortable there the entire time that I was there. We were in a variety of different places. I mean, it was a big shoot. You know, we shot for 5 days. So it wasn't just going to Auschwitz for one day and shooting it. We went to the tenement house where my mother and her family actually had been placed. And that was a very weird experience.
That was the hardest, I think, for your daughter as well. That was that one for both of you.
They were sort of all, that one was terrible. You know, the church, which is not in the original location, but at the end, you know, there were these dates where they were clearing out all the people from Tomaszynowo-Podlaskie, which was the town that my mother's family was from. And that church, for whatever reason, they decided to preserve it and they moved it to a different location. So we went to go see that church and Lindsay and I have the exact same reaction. It's just like we didn't even want to walk on the grass around it because it just felt like it was emanating evil. And then, of course, you know, how do you prepare yourself to walk into Auschwitz? And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, if you've been there, but like we just went through this nondescript building and then all of a sudden you're in Auschwitz. And the first thing you see, of course, is that very famous Arbeit macht frei fence. And it was, you know, we shot there for 2 days. It was really tough. And one of the most interesting things was we had, because we were there with a camera crew, Auschwitz, which is considered a museum, gave us a curator, non-Jewish man who'd been doing this for 26 years, and he was extraordinary.
Wow. And I also love, Audrey, that you're so authentic about it. You're not like a Pollyanna about it. Like when people ask, how do you feel now? Do you have this catharsis? You know, do you feel absolved? Do you feel... And you said, no. And I loved when you quoted the book way back from our younger days, I'm okay, you're okay, and you write about this. And I love that because it was like, no, this was not perfect, but I want you to describe to me what it was. And also when you quote the line from the Rolling Stones song, you can't always get what you want, but you get what you need. So I guess what I'm wondering is, did you get what you needed on that experience to Poland and Auschwitz with your daughter?
What I got was really two things, different understanding about two things. Ironically, when you're told since you're a young child that, you know, your parent, your mother and your grandmother were in Auschwitz, you always know that, but it loses its impact somehow, right? It's always part of your narrative and it loses its impact. But when you go to Auschwitz and you are standing there in front of crematoriums, when Mirek, the curator, standing there and telling me, I don't know how your mother survived, and this is the worst place on earth.
Yes.
You know, you come to terms with that. And so I think I did get empathy for my mother from that. And in a weird way, it became more personal, even though it had always been a part of my being. It was very hard to ignore. And in terms of what you were saying about the Pollyanna part of it, you know, there was so much secrecy and so much subversion. And even before what happened to my parents happened, I just knew that that wasn't healthy behavior and I couldn't do it. And I think not everybody can do that. And that's fine. Everybody has to choose the path that works for them.
Right.
But to me, you know, my mother, I grew up with a mother who said, well, her childhood wasn't so bad. She doesn't think she was profoundly affected by it. And, you know, and wow. We're like, okay, well, I'm profoundly affected by it, so I don't know how you know.
Right.
And I feel it's a disservice to hide that. I can't hide. And you know what? I'm like that in my career, too. And sometimes, like, I say, like, my personality can be polarizing because not everybody wants to hear the truth. Sometimes people just want to hear, yes, that's a great idea. Oh, of course. And I'm a little bit more doom and gloom, you know, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's interesting. Your mother was a 5-year-old survivor of Auschwitz, but your grandmother was an adult survivor, and yet she seemed so much more positive and optimistic, even having gone through it with an adult lens.
Yeah.
Can you speak about your relationship with your grandmother and how much you loved her and just her take on all of it, which was so different? Don't answer that just yet, Audrey. We're going to go on a short commercial break and more with celebrity publicist and author of the incredible new book, Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma, Audrey Hyams-Romoff, when we come back. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, and I'm here with Audrey Hyams-Romoff, owner of Overcat Communications and author of this incredible new book, Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma. And just before the break, Audrey, I asked you about your relationship with your beloved maternal grandmother and how this beautiful relationship affected you.
So my grandmother was 24 when she became a widow. And in the book, I do talk a little bit about their background. You know, they had a good life in Poland. They all came from big families. My grandfather was prosperous and everything evaporated, but there was such a strong appreciation of life and that she got to see her daughter grow up. And you know, my grandmother went through so much. So she was widowed for the first time when she was 24. Yes. And she remarried and she was widowed again when she was 47. So by the time she was 47, she'd had two husbands. She did marry later in life for a few years and was very happy. But she, you know, I talk in the book about we can carry our trauma around like a sack of potatoes. And my grandmother, you know, I just never relate to this too because you're a Montrealer, but she didn't drive. So I used to go with her to Steinberg's. And,
of course,
you know,
grocery store.
Yes. And anytime she was in line, she would become friends with everyone who was in this. She was such an outgoing person and she radiated so much. And, you know, when she passed away under unfortunate circumstances, also when she was 86, I still feel that loss so acutely. I still have her in my head and I think, would she be proud of me or would she not be proud of me? And I expressed that I don't think my mother and grandmother would have been very happy that Lindsay and I went to Poland and then to Auschwitz. I don't think that's something that they ever wanted this.
I think they'd be proud of this book, though. As a mother and a new grandmother, I'm going to say, I think they'd be proud of this achievement.
Well, they weren't so big on spilling secrets. So, you know, I'm not sure.
Your description of your father, we talked about this earlier on, reminded me of my beloved late father, Herbert Sivlin, who worked with Marvin Goldsmith. And then I read the acknowledgments and there he is. There's so many incredible references for anyone reading this from Montreal or from Toronto. Also, when you talked about the school with the nuns, I know you were talking about Marianopolis, which I attended as well. Yeah. So I thought that was so great. And also your mother studying at the Jewish General Hospital Nursing School, where my mother studied nursing as well. And what I felt very touched by in the book about your mother was when your daughter Lindsay was crying as a baby and your mother was quite calm about it, which actually helped you.
Yeah.
And I know the relationship was complicated, but was there any part of her nursing background that gave you comfort or that you were able to pass on to your children?
I'm going to say, unfortunately, not. I think with my mother, it was a little knowledge. I mean, she was a registered nurse. You know, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing because the anxiety and the fear really superseded it. But, you know, my father was a doctor and that was great. You know, when you have a doctor in the family, Yes. We had access to such good healthcare. I mean, it's very different when we moved to Toronto, but I was talking about, I got sick and my parents were in California and I got mono, and like literally I went and had an appointment with the head of hematology at the Jewish General Hospital. I waited there and they gave me the results. I mean, you know, that type of care is completely unheard of. So I did always have him as a resource. You know, my mother worried. So my mother knew a lot of things instead of saying, I mean, I know, you know, a lot of other nurses and they're like, no, don't worry about it. This is nothing. You know, my mother was, well, it could be this. It could be this. It could be this.
Right. But she was devastated when she got back from her holiday with your father, because you said, no, I'm going to be fine. And you stayed at home by yourself, nursing yourself really with mononucleosis, and you lost a tremendous amount of weight. And I want to get into the whole weight thing in a minute, but you lost a tremendous amount of weight and you were standing at the top of the stairs when she got home, and she was devastated when she saw you, you know, like.
Yeah, because I looked a little skeletal, you know, and it was interesting because like I got sick right before they left. They were going to California for 2 weeks and I was not getting better. I think the day after they left, that's when we went to see the head of hematology. Then that I had mono, and you know, my mother was, you don't want us to come home, do you? I'm thinking, yes, I actually do want you to come home. You know, for all the time I pushed you away, I actually need you. But they didn't seem like they wanted to come home. So I was like, okay, it'll be fine. I mean, ultimately it was fine, but yeah, I was.
But scary, I'm sure, for you. That was part of, there's so much trauma. Like, that's just part of trauma too, because it's scary to be sick and it's scary to be sick without your mother, and you somehow steeled yourself. You know, I think you really talk about this whole theme of intergenerational trauma and how there's actual science, epigenetics, dedicated to this. And just for our listeners, epigenetics is the field of study which describes how environmental experiences such as generational trauma can create chemical marks on your DNA that turn genes on or off, affecting how your brain and body respond to stress. Can you speak to this and just how this might have affected you and your daughter? Like, there were actually genes that might have been altered by this trauma that you all experienced.
I think that there's a few things. One of the things that was posited also, that my mother's brain development, because of, which, and that part is not necessarily genetic, but because of the trauma, because of the circumstances, because she was starved, you know, probably her brain development was altered, and that might have a lot to do with her personality and her anxiety and all that other sort of stuff. So in epigenetics, and a lot of that study has been done with Holocaust survivors for obvious reasons. And the theory is that not only is your DNA altered, but the DNA continues on and in multiple generations. So,
yes,
you know, the one thing is, I think it's very difficult to discern what is potentially genetic and what is environmental, because certainly in my household, there was a lot of environmental issues that were going on too. So I'm not a doctor, I'm not an expert on this, but I would say, I think both of those things are at play.
Of course.
And I think, you know, you have a pretty stacked deck against you when you have those genetic predispositions, and then you don't necessarily have the tools to deal with them initially because of environmental factors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what did it feel like for you when you realized that despite all of the trauma that you had endured, that the trauma still echoed for the next generation, for your daughter, Lindsay? And how have you worked together to process and reclaim your family story? Because I think going to Poland was part of it. How did she react to this experience of retracing your family's Holocaust history decades after the events?
You know, interestingly, when I spoke to her about it, she said it was a trip that she always wanted to take.
Wow.
But, you know, she wouldn't bring that up with me because she knew what my reaction to it would have been. So Lindsay was profoundly affected, as I mentioned, after my parents died. You know, she was 16. She was at a very impressionable stage. But we both went off the rails in different ways. And then she decided that she wanted to go to school in Montreal, which I was...
The opposite.
Yes. I was very much against, because going to Montreal is always complicated for me. And in particular, right after, for those first few intervening years, I didn't like going to Montreal at all. And I was there for business quite a bit. And it was very difficult for me. It was so important to her to go to Montreal that I agree. So she goes to Montreal. There's a lot of stuff that was going on that wasn't great, but I didn't find out until afterwards. And then she worked with me for a while. Then she went off and did her own thing. And, you know, about 10 years after my parents died, you know, around Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because that's the anniversary of their death, it's very difficult. And some years are more difficult than others. And one year she went to my husband, Michael, and said, I'm having a really hard time and I'd like to speak to mom about it, but I worry that if I bring it up, it's going to be so difficult for her, right? We're all trying to protect each other. So I felt that I had failed greatly by not picking up on the cues that my daughter needed that from me. And that was corrected immediately. So that was really sort of the beginning. I mean, we always had a good relationship, but that was the beginning of being able to build a better relationship. And when we were going to Poland, you know, I said to her, you know, I'm a little worried that I'm going to fall apart and I don't want that to be difficult for you. So I'm going to try to make sure that that doesn't happen. And she says to me, so she's done a lot of therapy, says, you know, we should just be authentic to ourselves. You should react the way you're going to react and I will react the way I'm going to react. And that was a very mature way, you know, of doing it. And it was difficult. And we found different things difficult, like first day of Auschwitz when we were at the crematorium in Auschwitz I, in the smaller part of Auschwitz, I sort of completely lost it. And she was more concerned about the second day at Auschwitz-Birkenau because that was where my mother and grandmother were interned and where they went to see what the bombs looked like and the big crematoriums and everything. And, it was difficult. But you
helped each other. It feels like you helped each other and you supported each other. And it's pretty miraculous. She feels like an adult person, too. Now it's two adults working together, right?
We're very similar. I have, for better or worse.
You look so much alike. You look like sisters in the pictures. It's crazy. Like, I'm like, look at these pictures. I'm like, wait a minute. Which one is Audrey? And I also love that, and there's a continuation in this history of that you, your mother and grandmother used to go to Place des Arts to see dance, to see ballet. And I just also could so picture that. And I know that you do ballet with your daughter as well. What do you love about dance?
You know, I think I was exposed to it from a very young age and I just became obsessed with it. And I think I had the build for it. So I did it and I was good at it. And I think like, most kids, you know, your parents try you out in different things. And then I realized, oh, I'm picking up this choreography a lot quicker than any of the other kids. And the teacher
great.
Asking me to go to the front of a class. And so, you know, you want to pursue things. Now, I didn't pursue it as far as I could have, although who knows where that went. And I definitely did push Lindsay to try to have the career that I didn't have. And she studied in New York. She did 2 summers at Albanelli. She did 2 summers at Dropley Ballet. And she was offered an internship in New York after she graduated from high school, which she decided not to take, which frankly broke my heart. But she said, you know, I'm the one who has to dance 8 hours a day, not you. So I get to make the decision, which is fair. And then I'm
fair.
Sure. Yes. I thought, well, you know, maybe since we look so much alike, I can just go impersonate you and nobody.
And they wouldn't know. They wouldn't know because you're.
They would have known by the age of the body.
So dance and eating often go hand in hand. And in the book, you write that you had 2 goals after your parents died: feel nothing, which I think you achieved for a number of years, and lose as much weight as possible, which you also achieved. You stopped eating after your parents' death, after they both died on that day. And as you've said in the book, why not? I was always the girl who was competing with herself to give the best answer in class, to collect the sales reports faster than anyone else. Now I was going to be the girl who didn't eat. And so you didn't eat for months. And evidently this man named Larry, you'll describe, noticed this finally. And said, you were shockingly thin. And maybe something, the way he said it or those words, shockingly thin, resonated. And you began and underwent a type of therapy called EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing. Can you tell us about that whole experience and how did that treatment help you?
You know, that treatment in general, so I had been in therapy off and on for a long time. I wasn't in therapy when my parents passed away. And I thought, I mean, there was so much to deal with and so much going on. But like a few months later, I thought, well, you know, maybe it would be a good idea to go back to therapy again. So I was just having trouble coping with a lot of things. Eating, obviously, well-known source of control. Also, I felt if I was hungry and uncomfortable, then that was the state that I should be in because my life is in a table and why should I feel any other way? And I was also having a lot of trouble concentrating, particularly at work. And the EMDR specifically helps with that. I didn't know what it was when I just said to my therapist, like, I'm having these issues. And she says, well, would you like to try EMDR? So she explains it to me. And it just has to do with eye movement. So
wow,
it's really interesting. And it did help.
Wow, that's incredible. How do you think you ultimately cope? Because I'm trying to imagine what that must have been like for a young girl. You go home, you go for the high holidays. I was just describing to someone this part in the book. I was saying it's like going for Christmas Eve to one family and for Christmas Day to another family. You went for the first night to one family, your husband's family, and one day to your family. You left and they always were so worried, are you going to call when you get home to Toronto? And you said, of course. And your father actually said to you, you write about in the book, he said, I know Audrey will call us, which was a very pivotal moment. And you did. You were in the middle of a campaign. You get home, you call, there's no answer. You call back later that night, there's no answer. You've got this little wiggly in your tummy, like this is not feeling good. You call in the morning at 6 a.m. or 6:30 in the morning. Your father was a surgeon. That was often when he was up. You would always be able to catch him at that hour. They don't answer. 6 hours later, you find out that your mother ended her life, committed suicide. It's unclear about what happened to your father, but they both died on that day. How does someone recover? Like, this is being a survivor of the Holocaust. There's all the other stuff, all the other trauma, but this is like huge. How did you get through those days? What helped you put one foot in front of the other? Because I was just trying to picture you dealing with this and I couldn't imagine it.
You know, there's with death.
I'm so sorry, by the way, that this happened to your parents. I just want to say that. You know, I'm so sorry for you and for your whole family.
I think that there's, when there's a death, then we'll say a simple death, there's all these things that you need to do, right? You need to start making arrangements and all this other stuff. For us, it was exponential. And we were also dealing with, you know, is very unexpected and there's sudden traumatic. But my son was at school. I had to go get him. I had to let my cousins know. I had to get a fold of my aunt, my father's sister, who was at the train station in Toronto before she got on a train and went back to my
family. Yes.
So there was all this stuff that was going on. And also because we lived in Toronto and the funeral was going to be in Montreal, you know, there was speaking to the funeral home and going to the funeral home and going to meet with the rabbi. You know, there was so many things to do. I didn't really think about it. And, you know, at one point in the book, I talk about how I think that, just in my opinion, this is not clinical, that there seems to be, to me, some sort of pathway that's similar when you're dealing with grief to being someone who is a substance abuser, because you have to really do take the life one day at a time. And sometimes it's 1 hour at a time. But, you know, I think something else I mentioned is, like, for months, I would wake up in the morning and I would, like, as soon as I would wake up, I would go, and like, I didn't even know why. Like, I knew that something terrible had happened, but I didn't know what it was. And then, of course, you remember it. And, you know, there's also a weird thing for me, which it wouldn't feel right to just forget it and move on and say that everything is okay, because I feel like that would be a disservice to my parents and the lives that they lived. And so I think people deal with grief differently. Some really want to let it go. Their path forward is they need to let it go and they need to move on, which is great and healthy. It's just not what I can do.
This is, though, severe post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
And I know you went to many therapists after until you found the right one, which you did. Yeah. But did you have a person, a grief counselor that you talked to at the time of this terrible tragedy?
I did have that therapist, but I also had a very close friend who, with the child of two Holocaust survivors, who is a therapist. And she made herself very available to me. You know, one of the things when you're going through postnatal grief and like you have all these people who are trying to help you and jumping on you and what can they do for you? And like, it's overwhelming. And I'm not one of those people who wants a lot of people around. I want to be alone. I want to be alone in my misery. And she sort of cut through that. And she was like, I'm coming to your house every Wednesday morning. And so she was a great resource because we've known each other since we were 17. We led similarly parallel lives. And because her parents were the Holocaust survivors, you find people along the way that are the people that, you know, support you. And, you know, I like to think that my first thought was, well, I'm not going to fall apart because I can't fall apart from my kids. Well, I didn't really fall apart in the way that you might think about falling apart, you know, like my mother did. I didn't take to my bedroom. I continued functioning at a very high level, but like I was a disaster. And, you know, my husband was watching this one year when I was traveling across Canada with an indie rock band and
the boy band.
The boy band. Drinking and drinking. I mean, yeah. It was just something I'd been working on before my parents died. And it just happened to coincide. The planning just happened to coincide. And like, I was like, this is great. I'm not going to sleep. I'm going to get to drink all the time. I get to hang out, you know, live this life that is so foreign. It was second adolescence.
You even got carded, right? Like, they even thought that you were underage.
Oh my God.
That's pretty cool though.
That was cool. Yeah. And it was really funny because she looks at my card, she hands it back to me and she goes, I never would have guessed that. So it was like, yes, you know, kudos.
That's
for that.
Impressive. That's a pretty good thing.
It was. I don't even know how you get through things. And you just did. You put one foot in front of the other, and sometimes it's terrible. You know, I write about in the book and in a few different instances, like talk about compartmentalization is really the best life skill my mother ever gave me. And because that's how we were raised, right? There was a lot of chaos that was happening at home, but we're still going to look good and we're still going to go out and we're still going to perform. And that's why I can do it. But you hide a lot, right? And I think the book was maybe about giving a glimpse behind all of that hiding.
So I sort of said this at the beginning, that there's all this trauma and this is all juxtaposed with your very glamorous life as the head of your publicity communications firm, Overcat, and the clients that you work with, the A-list Hollywood celebrities and glitterati that you deal with. You know, we're going to hear all about that when we come back after this short commercial break. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, and I'm here with author of the new book, Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma, and founder of Overcat Communications, Audrey Hyams-Romoff. Audrey, what was it like starting your fabulous A-list celebrity PR firm in the beginning? And what was it like starting that company and having two children within 2 years?
Oh, stupid. You know, listen, you're very accomplished. You have kids. You have a career. And you think before you get into it, well, this won't be a problem. Of course I can do this. No, I was
very hard.
Very, very hard. And also, I didn't think that I was going to have this persistent morning sickness. So I was used to crazy long hours and all this other sort of stuff. So it was dumb. And what I say is, and I'm really open about it because I think it's important that other women don't buy into this narrative that everything is perfect and you're going to look great and you're going to feel great and you're going to be able to function and not sleep and your babies are going to be perfect. And I know I've said this before, but I think it's such a disservice to other women that you're not helping any. And like, if you're one of those mothers that can do that, that's great. But I went back to work full time when Lindsay was 5 weeks old. So, you know, it was absolutely
crazy.
It was good.
You write with the A-list Hollywood celebrities, the glitz and glamour that juxtaposes all of the other trauma and tragedy in your life. And you write, the agency just kept getting busier and busier. Events in New York for Sarah Jessica Parker, Jennifer Lopez, and Jon Bon Jovi. Yes, he's even better looking in person and totally charming. Yeah. Celine Dion in Vegas. Like, wow. A press trip to Sweden for IKEA. How would you describe that whole period in your life and career? Like, that must have been thrilling, that part.
I would like to say that I wish I had appreciated it more. I mean, the world has changed so much post-COVID and the way in communication strategy, and you know, that's a whole other thing, which I'm sure you're very familiar with as well.
Yes.
But it was great. You know, I mean, we worked on Sarah Jessica Parker's fragrance launch. And so the first event that we did was in New York. And this was like at the height of Sex and the City. And I was like,
Oh,
so completely obsessed with sex.
I was obsessed then, and I'm re-obsessed because my daughter just watched the entire series, all six seasons, and I just rewatched all of it. And I think I like it better now than then.
It's amazing.
So good.
So it was so interesting. So we were at a beautiful hotel and there was a brunch, and we were a small group, like maybe 20 people were all at this table. And when you meet celebrities, it's like this very weird thing that happens because you feel like you know them so well because, you know their characters and you follow their lives. I mean, there wasn't social then. Now you feel like you know them even more. And so then all of a sudden, you know, here's Sarah Jessica. And like, wait, that's Sarah Jessica. And she did the cutest thing. She walks around the table and she goes up to everyone and she puts her hand in and she goes, "Hi, I'm Sarah Jessica." As if, yes.
Doy, der.
We know who you are.
Yeah.
So you know what? It was great. I was in my career for sure. I was at the right place at the right time when all of this celebrity stuff was happening. Celebrity brand endorsement was happening, and the company I was consulting for was really at the forefront of that. Now it happens a lot more often than it did. But yeah, it was pretty great. It was pretty fun.
That's so fabulous. There's so much in the book. You know, I know I can't get to all of it, but I might just tell the listeners before your royal wedding, there's a great story in the memoir about the smuggling of the diamond. This was in your grandmother's best friend's tooth, right? Which later became your engagement ring, and your mother helped create that ring with Michael, your husband. What are your memories of that day when you got that ring?
Oh my God. So, I mean, we were going back and forth to Montreal and Toronto all the time. And I guess we must have flown in, and my father-in-law picked us up at the airport, and we were driving, I think, to my parents' house, and Michael got in the back seat with me. I don't know why. Maybe they sort of intended to put a suitcase in the front seat or whatever it was.
Right. They staged it a bit.
Yeah. And then, so, you know, all of a sudden he has the ring, and, you know, it really was very much a collaborative effort. My mother played a great part in that ring. She was very enthusiastic when I became engaged. You know, she became a little over controlling about my wedding, but you know, there were a couple of diamonds and she offered me whichever one I wanted. And I took one that was a bit smaller and it was imperfect because that was the story. And I knew the woman who had sorted it out of Germany in the tooth. So it was really, really meaningful. So it was very exciting and it was a beautiful ring. And my mother, when she was in New York on one of her visits, had gotten a Van Cleef catalog and we found a ring. And so we designed the ring together. So,
oh, that's so fabulous. I think your parents' wedding was officiated by the esteemed Rabbi Shushat at the Shor Shamayim Synagogue in Montreal. That is incredible.
Rabbi Shushat married my parents. And I really wanted him to marry Michael and I as well. But I think he was unavailable. And then eventually he retired and he did come out of retirement to do the eulogy for my parents.
Yes.
You know, parents' funeral. And, you know, we had a very close relationship. He was the head rabbi at Shor Shamayim. We had a very long history with that synagogue. You know, we were married there. I actually did my son's bar mitzvah there. We were members. We went every high holiday. And my father and mother were like a very big part of that community. So it was very meaningful.
Our family went there as well. And I sat with my grandmother in O on the right side.
On the main floor?
Yeah,
on in the right O. side. Okay.
On the right side.
Q on the left side. Wow, that's so funny.
So this is when I tell you I'm reading this and it's like it's reverberating and resonating because it's, first of all, just for someone who doesn't even know Montreal, it will do that. But add to that all of these references.
Wow,
and it was pretty
so
incredible.
And we remember the row, right? How significant that we remember the row. I will always remember row Q.
Also old phone numbers. I remember my late beloved grandmother's phone number, 933-5353.
Wow.
514.
Yeah.
That never leaves you, right? Your memoir explores inherited grief and resilience, but also hope and moving forward, thanks to the work that you've done. What do you hope readers, especially those with no personal ties to the Holocaust, will take away from your story?
You know, when I wrote it, you know, I've met a lot of people who have gone through very difficult things. And it was important to me, if possible, to try to create a narrative that a broader cross-section of people could relate to, that it wasn't just, yes, our story starts with the Holocaust, but that's not the only bad story out there. There's a lot of other really terrible stories that are out there. And even things that aren't necessarily, you know, on a global scale, but within families and things that happen. And so I just felt sometimes people can't talk about it or won't talk about it. And if it helps to make people feel like they're not alone, if it makes them feel that they can speak to someone, whether it's professional or whether it's their parents or whether it's their, you know, friends and peers, that you're not alone. And sometimes it does help. And also at the end of the book, I say, my life isn't tied up in a bow, although ironically I am wearing a bow, but I don't feel in my life that it's possible that it be all tied up with this pretty bow. And that's okay. You have to learn to live with it. And I think one of the other things, you know, there's a chapter about empathy, which because I had gone through so much in my life, yes, that when friends of mine who were going through, I mean, people who are very close to, were going through something, I wanted to be there for them. And they sought me out too, because it very much works that way, right? When you're going through grief, there's very specific people that are, yes, giving you what you need.
Totally.
And I felt that was as helpful for me, you know, as it was for them. And I think, you know what, our world is so crazy right now for a bunch of reasons. And I think a little humanity and sympathy and empathy can go a long way.
Absolutely true. How is life right now, if you had to describe it in a postscript?
It's interesting, right? Because this is a whole new thing for me. I run a communications agency. I've been doing that for decades. But, you know, now I'm learning about something new. And of course, I was always the person who booked people on shows like yours. And now I'm the person who goes on shows like yours. So it's very interesting learning about, you know, the publishing industry and all the stuff that I'm doing. It's good. I'm enjoying it. And, you know, my 26, the book just launched. So there's a lot of activity that's still coming out. So I'm very grateful for
it. Is this becoming a movie? Is this becoming a film?
Oh God, I hope so. If anyone is watching this, I'm dying to sell the script. So
I want to tell you something. Definitely. It's got a lot of film vibes.
Thank you.
I can see it. There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, I'm going to ask it to you now. What is bliss for Audrey Hyams-Romoff?
I knew you were going to ask that. So two things. I mean, the most important thing is that the people that I'm closest to and love are safe and okay. So that's the most important thing. So that's the serious one. And the other thing is, you know, I rev at a pretty high gear and it's hard for me sometimes to cool down. So before COVID, we got these two rescue kittens and I'm desperately in love with them. They're cats now. And you know, the female one, if I get into bed, she likes to jump on the bed and snuggle with me and purr. And it is my happiest moment. So once I know everyone's safe and sound, I can have a few minutes with Buffy, you know, purring while I'm laying in bed. That's my bliss.
That's so great. I have to tell you, Audrey, it's really been an absolute honor to have you on the program. And I'm so delighted. And I love your book.
Thank you.
And I am recommending it like crazy. Everyone, it's called The Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma by Audrey Hyams-Romoff. Thank you for being here.
Judy, it was such a joy. Thank you very much.
Each week, we spotlight a fabulous person like Audrey Hyams-Romoff, who is living their bliss. For those of you who don't know, I'm also the Bliss Coach. Reach out to me at findingyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. In Bliss News, we're so excited to announce our phenomenal giveaway, courtesy of Audrey Hyams-Romoff and Rebooks Publishing. We're giving away two copies of The Ripple Eclipse, Turning the Tide of Inherited Trauma by Audrey Hyams-Romoff. And to enter, all you have to do is follow us at The Bliss Minute and follow at Audrey Hyams-Romoff and Rebooks Publishing on Instagram. So just at The Bliss Minute, at Audrey Hyams-Romoff, and at Rebooks Publishing on Instagram. Then just like the giveaway post, tag two friends, and the contest runs from January 28th to February 3rd. The winners will be announced February 3rd at 6 p.m. Good luck, everyone, and happy reading. I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Audrey Himes-Romoff, for being on the show today. It was so delightful to have her here. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, producer Chelsea Lockstedt, Eva Shabbatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Giuliano Yannizziello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. And as well, thank you to Garrett Flores for the beautiful pink roses that adorn our set each week. For everyone here, I'm Judy Lee Brack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.